Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The critical battle space in that war, of course, is always the United States Congress. And it has so many responsibilities, not least of which is, of course, oversight, but also legislation with respect to the common defense and the common weal, for that matter. A man in the midst of all of that is our first guest. He is Representative Mike Kelly. He represents the people of my home state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's 3rd District, with great distinction. He serves on the House Ways and Means Committee. They usually describe it as the powerful Ways and Means Committee. It is, of course, involved in, among other things, tax writing policy. In fact, Representative Kelly serves on its subcommittee focusing on that topic, and it's great to have a chance to visit with him about that, among other things. Congressman, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Oh, thank you, Frank. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So there's obviously a lot of focus, conversation, I guess incipient debate about what tax policy reforms will be taking place here very shortly. Can you shed some light inside baseball and otherwise on what is happening on the Hill and what you think will come of all of this?
Yeah. Well, we continue to have briefings with Ways and Means members and then Ways and Means staff. I think the big work has been done, of course, by the Big Six. But Chairman Brady has been very open to having folks come in and explain where we're trying to get and the effect that it has. And I think the concern we always have is it truly pro-growth tax reform? And are tax cuts for everybody across the board the way we want to go? And the answer is yes and yes. So we look at two different aspects of it, of course, the corporate tax reform that makes us competitive across a global surface right now, that right now we are not competitive because not only of our tax code, but some of our regulations. So we're looking at that at the corporate side and keeping in mind that that is 10% of our total revenue. The individual tax reform or the personal tax cuts are the ones that I'm looking at right now. We're all looking at on the committee to make sure that they are pro-growth and that we're actually taking care of the people to pick up 90% of the tab when it comes to paying taxes. The tax revenue comes in from individuals, 90% of our revenue from individuals, 10% from corporate. Right now, corporate's getting an awful lot of attention, but I like to look at the folks when I go back home, look them square in the eye and say, you know, you're really the ones that pick up the majority of all the revenue that goes into this wonderful government we have to supply all the different programs.
Do you anticipate, Congressman, and taxes as something that I have to attend to as one of those citizens contributing, of course, but it's not the principal focus of this program, but I just would ask, there's a lot of talk about how to make these tax cuts that are now very appetizing work in a revenue neutral way, if possible, or simply be offset to some extent, at least, without taking away tax deductions that are very popular with the American people. Do you see a way to work through that difficult pass?
And you hit the nail on the head. That is a really difficult task. As we went into this, my question from the beginning was the policies that we're talking about now, that we're no longer calling them good tax policy, we're calling them pay force to reduce the rates down, are we taking away from something that was initially put into our tax code and to encourage some type of behavior, and it was pro-growth behavior? So you got to be very careful about how you play with these different levers and say, well, wait a minute, we're going to need that as a pay for lowering the rates. So I want to make sure that we keep in mind why it is we put those policies in place and the actual effect of those policies when it comes to our tax revenue streams.
We wish you great luck on this. Let me turn to another topic that I know you have been focusing on as well, sir, and that is the Iran deal. President Trump has shifted direction. He hasn't actually extricated us from the deal just yet, which is what I hope he will do. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the fact that he's lobbed back into Congress's lap the idea of reimposing sanctions on Iran. Is that going to happen? Should it?
I think it should. First of all, it should, because the Iran deal was only good for Iran. It was certainly not good for us. It was not good for the rest of the world. And their behavior since that time has negated any type of the sense of there was a good understanding between the parties. I was appalled at the time. But again, you go back to the Obama administration. I think President Obama had this idea, if we treat them nice, they'll treat us nice. He really never understood the fact that anytime America shows kindness to somebody, the opponent looks at it as weakness. We never even got back the hostages that they were holding before we even sat down at the table. That should have been a prerequisite to even sitting down with these bad actors. But since that time, there's been violations. And when it comes to the arming of these terrorist states, the funneling of money, the fact that Iran says, no, you can't visit these sites unless you give us enough timing so we can clean it up before you get there. Everything about this stinks from day one. I have absolutely no idea other than the fact that I think President Obama, in his mind, just thought, if we act nice, they'll act nice. That's not the way it works with these folks. It never will. It's generational. It's cultural. It's such a divide between the two of us, the two countries, and the rest of the world that I think we're foolish when we sit down and think that we can somehow forge some kind of an agreement by giving these folks everything up front and asking nothing in return. It made absolutely no sense at the time. It's gotten worse as time's gone on. And I think it only gets worse for not only for the United States, but also the world.
We look forward to your leadership in trying to remedy this with a restoration of the kinds of impediments to the Iranians' ambitions. Let me turn to one other topic you've also been focused on, and I know this is a work in progress as well, so you may want to hedge. But what do you think should be the appropriate course of action for the Congress on this so-called deferred action for these children who came in illegally into the United States, the so-called DACA kids?
Yeah, the dreamers. I think the president was exactly right when he said, you know what, this is the responsibility of Congress. It should go back to Congress, and Congress should come up with some type of a fix that how we're going to address it, laying it right back in the laps of the people who are absolutely responsible for it. We've talked about immigration reform for so many years, and I think all we do is continue to talk about it. And I think the only result of any of the meetings is establishing a date for the next meeting. We don't see anybody moving forward on it. But I like the president's approach to it, saying, you know what, let's leave into Congress the responsibilities that Congress has, and the executive branch will stay in the back, and we will enforce the laws once they're passed and they go into effect. But what has happened before, and again, when we look at the 8 years of the Obama administration, all of the things that could have been done, or that the president, President Obama, had talked about having done his first 2 years in office, he had absolutely no roadblocks in front of him. He didn't need one Republican vote for anything. If he was so hell-bent on getting immigration fixed and getting DACA fixed, he should have done it then instead of stopping after this crazy idea of the Affordable Care Act and then sitting back and resting on his laurels and say, you know what, I'll just let all this stuff come into place after I'm out of office when there's something to be faced. So, no, I like President Trump's approach to it. He's truly an executive that says, you know what, we delegate powers to certain people, and then we tell people it's not only your responsibility, you have to get these things done and come back to us with what we think the appropriate action is. The trouble is, too many times Congress would rather cede that responsibility to somebody else rather than be accountable for it.
So we'll stay tuned to see what Congress comes up with in this regard, but I hope it will, among other things, ensure that there isn't a magnet effect for still more of these folks to come through. Let me ask you lastly, very quickly, Congressman. We're watching a drama play out on the other side of the Hill at the moment, with now two members of the United States Senate announcing they will not seek re-election. That seemed to be because they probably would not be re-elected had they sought it. But they're now using the opportunity to essentially tear into the president. And I just wonder what you make of this kind of fratricidal impulse on the part of other members of the Republican caucus, albeit in this case on the other side of the Hill.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that too often personalities have become a distraction for policy that needs to be addressed. Whether the senators feel that they have to do this or not, I would just refer again to the last the 8 years before President Trump was sworn into office. I mean, if Mr. Reid had had any problem with any of his members or had any problem with President Obama, it certainly never hit the public. If Ms. Pelosi had ever had any problems with any of her members or any of her members had any problem with President Obama, certainly you never saw any of them running to a microphone or to a TV camera to tell just how upset they were with President Obama, Ms. Pelosi, or Mr. Reid. I think it's kind of typical of Republicans. For some reason, we just can't have our discussions on the inside and work it out. the other side follows that old adage that there's no problems in our families. There's just a lot of things we don't talk about.
It does seem as though it's, in, at least in part, a function of the fact that there's a great appetite in the press, most especially, for Republicans engaging in this kind of knife fighting amongst themselves. Not so on the Democratic side. Congressman Mike Kelly, it's great to have a chance to talk with you, sir, and I appreciate so much your leadership on all of these issues. We'll look forward to hearing progress reports from you if we can in the future. Diana West joins us next. We'll talk a little bit about the unfolding scandal on Capitol Hill with respect to Hillary Clinton. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist and blogger par excellence. You can find her work collected helpfully at dianawest.net. She is, of course, the author, among many things, of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. A lot to talk about.
Well, there is. As we were discussing previously with Congressman Mike Kelly, I wanted particularly to get into some of the work that you've been doing and the analysis you've been conducting of others about this effort by the Russians to obtain uranium from the United States, and the lengths they seem to have gone to enlist the help of the Clinton circle at a moment when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and her husband, of course, was making speeches, and the Clinton Foundation was seeking contributions. What do you make of what we've learned of late?
Well, we're learning more and more about the rank corruption of the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton in terms of what was going on at the highest levels of understanding and investigation and awareness of this effort to take our uranium, to enrich the Clintons, to pretend that this Russian reset that the Obama administration inaugurated was good for the country. It's mind-boggling what we're listening to, what we're learning almost daily, because there's no effort, it seems, to bring any of these actors to justice. And this is where we all need to be very vigilant and push our representatives.
And those representatives seem, rather belatedly, but now seem to be intent on looking into this. You mentioned in a recent posting, Diana West, that Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was pursuing a line of questioning with Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, about all of this. Does this suggest that not only these questions are going to be posed, but there will be a determined effort to get answers about the extent of actual collusion with Russia by the Clinton circle and, for that matter, others in the Obama administration?
Well, it definitely is a healthy sign, and I commend Senator Grassley for his efforts. I think we have a lot of the answers at this point. Certainly, there is a role for investigation to continue. However, the stopping point at this time appears to be the Trump Justice Department and Attorney General Sessions. Now, there may be efforts going on behind the scenes that Attorney General Sessions does not wish to disclose, but the attitude he displayed in his exchange with Senator Grassley was disturbing, was alarming in the sense of it felt like a brush off. This information is out there, and indeed the most recent revelations concerning the corruption and bribery case that add to the story, almost ancillary in the sense that we already know about the $145 million that people connected with Uranium One, the Canadian company that had control of our stocks, 20% of our uranium stocks, poured into the Clinton Foundation. I mean, this is already documented. So we know what was going on to such a great extent, and yet we're still seeing this effort at the very top too slow walk the whole thing and hope it all goes away.
Well, let me just drill down on that, Dinah, because it does seem as though the Attorney General, among others, must be bemused, shall we say, at the very least, if not rendered incapacitated by the fact that virtually everywhere he looks around him at the moment, there are individuals who are actively involved in investigating Donald Trump and alleged collusion by him or his surrogates with the Russians, of which there's no evidence at the moment, as far as I can tell, but who were also implicated in either the initial investigation of the Clinton team or what appears now to be a cover-up of the results of that investigation. Let's name the names. Robert Mueller, then the director of the FBI, now the special counsel, James Comey, then his buddy, now the ex-director of the FBI and a star witness, it would appear, in the Mueller investigation. Rod Rosenstein, now Jeff Sessions' number two, at the time the U.S. attorney overseeing this Clinton investigation. Andrew McCabe, the number two in the FBI, who was a senior official there during this investigation. I mean, it goes on and on. So what do you think, Dinah, should be done about, at the very least, what would now appear to be simply discrediting conflicts of interest at best, and if not perhaps actual malfeasance on the part of these individuals?
Yes, well, what you're describing is the breakdown of the process. It's the breakdown of the rule of law, and citizens will have no confidence in the government unless this situation is rectified. The easiest fix, and I believe Senator Grassley has recently called for this, is a special counsel, someone unconnected to any of these people, to look into the Uranium One deal, the Clinton Foundation connection to it, and take care of this in terms of restoring the rule of law, restoring the confidence of people in the government, which, if this goes on, I think the disaffection and disconnection of the people from the government is practically unrectifiable. This is exactly the kind of situation President Trump was elected to correct, simply to show and restore the fact that America is not supposed to be a country like a banana republic, like a totalitarian dictatorship, where there is one law for the powerful and one law for you and me. This is the heart and soul of the Trump presidency rests in how this situation is dealt with. And at the moment, it is not enough for President Trump to tweet. It is not enough for him to remain disconnected from this. And it is not enough for his aides to do everything in their power to keep him disconnected from this, which is how I read it. And Jeff Sessions, if he is unable to deal with this, he should step down and allow someone to better serve the president, because his recusal on the Clintons, his recusal on the Russia matter at this point are doing much more harm than any good he can do as Attorney General.
Dinah, let me switch gears slightly to talk about something that you've also spent a lot of time thinking about. It seems as though there is another complication here. This Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States that has been responsible for overseeing transactions like Uranium One to try to prevent damage from being done to the national security by, you know, people selling off vital assets, was staffed. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, that is CFIUS as it's known, was staffed by a fellow by the name of Ayman Mir. It turns out he is a Pakistani expatriate, evidently a Sharia supremacist with ties, personal as well as familial, to the Muslim Brotherhood, and perhaps, who knows, even the Pakistani intelligence. My head is exploding. This new development, this new wrinkle that suggests that perhaps the Uranium One deal and other transactions of concern may have been influenced by such an individual. Your thoughts on that?
Well, yes, it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling, and that, again, another log on this burning fire here in terms of where are our elected officials who are either, who are sworn to uphold and protect our Constitution, have a duty toward the American people. Where are they? Where is the American interest? this is exactly the sort of thing that President Trump's administration should be addressing.
Well, it is, and it's the sort of thing that we address, and we're always delighted to do it with you. Diana West, thank you very much for joining us at Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us each week. We'll look forward to doing so again. Stephen Bucci of the Heritage Foundation joins us. Next, we'll talk about Niger and what our forces are doing there and why is this such a controversy at the moment. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is a great pleasure and real honor, I think, to have with us a distinguished combat veteran, a man who has served both as a member of the Army's Special Forces, the Green Beret, but also in a number of civilian capacities at the highest level of the United States government, and rendered real service there, as well as in his subsequent role with the Heritage Foundation, where these days he is a visiting fellow. His name is Dr. Colonel Stephen Bucci, United States Army retired. A great friend of this program and a really important contributor to the public policy debate, including as a contributor to Heritage Foundation's Daily Signal. It's great to catch up with you. Thanks so much for joining us, Steve.
It's always a pleasure to be on the show with you, Frank.
Good. Let me ask you about a piece that you've recently filed in the aftermath of the tragic loss of four of your comrades in the Green Beret in Niger. It's turned into, I don't need to tell you, a political football. And you've said, wait a minute, this is a routine activity. There's nothing secret about it. Don't politicize it. Tell us a little bit about the backstory here as you see it, Steve, and what should be our proper takeaway from it all.
Well, first, you know, the breathless reporting one sees and the action on the Twitter sphere of some people. I had to finally say something because they're making it sound like this was some super secret Jason Bourne-ish mission that the president had snuck in on Congress. And that's crazy. This mission started and was briefed to Congress the first time in 2013. It's been briefed every year since then. It is a standard Special Forces mission that we call foreign internal defense, where our guys go in very small numbers to work with, train, and advise friendly host nation forces, in this case the military of the country of Niger, because there's a potential threat. The overall goal is with a few guys, we train them what to do so that we don't have to go fight that threat later ourselves with much larger formations of Americans.
Yeah. And I'd like to draw on the fact that you served as a special forces operative in Africa during your military career to give us a sense, Steve, as to what is happening on the ground there.
As you know, the northern tier of Africa, the countries that border the southern end of the Mediterranean, many of them have majority Arab population. So obviously most of those folks are Muslims. And then if you go down to that next tier below them, the countries that are sort of half in North Africa and half in sub-Saharan Africa, Niger being one of those, Mali being right next door being another, it's a pretty mixed group of Muslim and non-Muslim populations. There's a lot of tension. There's always been tension there. When I served in Kenya, several of the cities there, they used to joke that they were little Beirut's because they had half the city was Muslim and half the city were Christian, and there was like lines of demarcation between them. Well, first Al-Qaeda and now ISIS is trying to leverage those divisions in those areas to stir up more animosity between those communities and to recruit to their radical Islamist ideologies. And that puts those countries at risk. It puts the region at risk, and it puts our national security at risk because a lot of those folks are our friends.
There seems to be kind of a subtext here, Steve, and I just wonder whether I'm being too cynical about this or whether the cynicism is warranted. that somehow, as you say, there was something nefarious going on. This was Donald Trump's responsibility, even to the point where a parallel seems at least subliminally being promoted, that this is kind of his Benghazi scandal. You've looked hard, I know, at that earlier and tragic debacle under the Clinton and Obama operation in the State Department and the White House, respectively. Is there a parallel to be drawn there? Is there anything remotely comparable?
First, I don't think there is anything remotely comparable. I do think it's humorous that the people that are saying this is Trump's Benghazi all along have been denying that Benghazi was even an issue. Look, Benghazi was, you know, first of all, bad judgment as far as what security was there. Second, bad judgment and politically driven choices as to our immediate response. And then finally, politically driven cover-ups of what really happened there for a long period of time, and then a denial that they'd ever lied about it afterward. This is another tragedy. You know, Americans die. It's a tragedy. When Americans are doing their job and bad guys attack them, it is a tragedy. That's the only similarity, that they're both tragedies. This was an ongoing mission. Oh, by the way, started during the Obama administration, but a good, legitimate mission that was continued under President Trump, rightfully so. Guys doing their job were looking into it because the military always investigates this stuff, which is another point I get ticked about when I hear news people saying that their reporting provoked the Pentagon to do an investigation. What a bunch of baloney. The Pentagon always does those investigations. We always want to do better next time, but this has been open, transparent, and completely above board.
No kidding. Let me switch gears with you to take advantage, Stephen Bucci, of your experience both in the military itself, but also in senior roles in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Steve Bucci, I did want to ask you about a recent poll conducted by the Military Times that seems to suggest there's a very significant problem with white supremacism in the United States military. What's your attitude towards the poll, first of all, and to its finding?
First, Frank, I think if you look at it, what the poll said was that one in four service members had seen some evidence of white supremacist in their career.
So it's not that one in four people are actually white supremacists. Got it. That's an important correction.
Yeah. You know, they could have all seen the same guy. I mean, that's an overstatement the other direction, but we don't know. The other thing is that the report really does not adequately explain the questions that were asked, what provoked that response. You know, were there other even-handed questions? So there's some questions about the validity of the poll, frankly. The United States military is a reflection of our society. Are there people in the United States military who may have some sort of aberrant policy positions or ideological positions? Absolutely. As a military officer, we looked for stuff like that. We looked for anybody who was radicalized, far left, far right, you know, religiously militant. We looked for that stuff. So they're out there. Is it a massive problem that's going to skew our military and cause them to take behavior that's unacceptable? No, it isn't. It is not that big a problem. I think this is the mainstream press grabbing on a skewed poll and going, oh my God, this really pushes our beliefs. We're going to go for this. The leadership of our military is on this. We have no history of direct political action in the United States military. We've never had a coup. You know, we are not about to break that rule. And frankly, if you think about it, there were lots of people on the left who were calling for the military to rise up and oust President Trump. And every military commentator, whether in uniform or somebody like me who's former uniform, went nuts and said, what are you, crazy? You do not want our military to do that ever. So I think our military is solid. It is based on our Constitution, which is what we swear allegiance to. And that military ethos is still exceedingly strong.
Amen. And thank you for both exemplifying it as well as explaining it to the rest of us. Stephen Bucci at the Heritage Foundation, I know you will keep up your good work, and I hope you will come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, about the latest on the investigations on Capitol Hill. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by the Senior Vice President at the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs, our friend as well as colleague, Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional with extraordinary duty service in the Central Intelligence Agency, in the State Department under Ambassador John Bolton, and on Capitol Hill as a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee. It's always a good moment when we're able to visit with him, and I appreciate, Fred, you taking the time today to do so. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Frank, good to be here.
Fred, of course, you have been on the Iran deal, like the proverbial white on rice. It has been, I think, an extraordinary service you've rendered to us in understanding, among other things, through your book, Obama Bomb, The Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, and your extraordinary productive contributions through other outlets as this story has unfolded. One of the things I just wanted to ask you about quickly is the president signaled the other day that he didn't know that it would be a problem if the Europeans continued doing what they're determined to do, evidently, which is to provide life support for the Iranian regime, selling things to them, buying things from them, otherwise engaging with them economically. What are your thoughts on how serious a mistake that might be?
Yes, Frank, I heard that comment in an interview with Maria Bartiromo, and I was sort of hoping that the president misspoke, because there's really no way to correct this dangerous situation created by Barack Obama and the Iran deal unless we crack down on trade with Iran and tell European states that you simply can't trade with Iran, especially sensitive trade, unless Iran actually agrees to a meaningful nuclear agreement, which I think is the chances of that are remote. And I sort of attribute this, Frank, to bad advisors. The president is surrounded by people like H.R. McMaster and Secretary of State Tillerson, who want us to stay in this nuclear deal. And I think they are giving him bad advice every single day. And really, the solution to this is the president needs to clean house, get rid of people who are giving him bad advice that is inconsistent with his beliefs and what he campaigned on, and put together a legitimate national security cabinet that would promote the security of our country and what he campaigned on as for president.
Yeah. Amen. I fear that some of that is also coming from the Goldman Sachs representatives that are much in evidence in his administration and who, you know, presumably are hearing from their friends across the pond that businesses got to take precedence over everything else. A problem that we've seen, by the way, in this so-called Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States as well, that we were talking about earlier in the program with Diana West, that's supposed to be evaluating clear-eyed the national security implications of transactions, but regrettably all too frequently wind up promoting business interests, even very short-term business interests at the expense of the larger national interests. Fred, let me turn to China. I know that you've also been following this closely. You've edited a very important monograph for us last year about China preparing for conflict and the prospect that we best be doing the same or else. Let me ask you, Fred, we are hearing reports out of Beijing at the moment that Xi Jinping is consolidating power. He's clearly doing so at a time that is helping prop up another dangerous regime, namely North Korea. There have been some interesting responses by President Trump, though, and I'd like to have you explore those with us.
Well, I don't think we know where Xi Jinping is going. I think we have to understand that with this massive military buildup under Xi and its efforts to establish bases in the South China Sea and seize this entire area as Chinese territory, this is a nation that's pursuing goals that are inimical to American national security and global security. On the other hand, because of pretty intense pressure by President Trump on China, China appears to be actually implementing Security Council resolutions and going beyond them. It implemented a very important resolution that was passed after last month's test of a supposed hydrogen bomb by North Korea, actually imposed them ahead of schedule. It had 120 days to do so and went beyond what was called for. I mean, this is a positive sign. I don't think it means that China is less of a threat. What I think it means is that U.S. and President Trump have gotten through to President Xi that North Korea poses a serious security threat to China, especially if some of these underground nuclear tests breach the surface and start venting radiation throughout the Asia-Pacific region.
We'll be following it closely, as I know will you, Fred. But one other thing that President Trump has done, specifically, I think, calculated to get the attention of the North Koreans, is upping the presence of the United States military and the level of alert of some elements of its strategic nuclear deterrent. What did you make of that, Fred?
I think it was a very important move. He's putting our B-52 bombers on 24-hour alert. He's sending a second and third aircraft carriers into the region. This is the president backing up his words. He's not just condemning North Korea, and that's what we used to hear from President Obama. He'd make high-sounding speeches, and then he did nothing. This doesn't mean we're going to attack, but it's giving the message to North Korea and to China that the president will use military action, if necessary, to defend our interests and the interests of our allies, just like he said in his speech to the UN General Assembly.
It is a sea change from what we've seen before. It's frankly heartening as well that we're not going to just get empty rhetoric out of the president. It will bear considerable watching how the North Koreans respond, of course, and I hope that while he's at it, he's going to do some other things, notably bringing our missile defenses up to the full capability that we need them to have to contend with not just the North Korean threat, by the way, but the Chinese and Russians as well. Fred, let me ask you finally about one last item, drawing upon your experience on Capitol Hill. The Republicans seem to finally be taking somewhat to heart their responsibilities for oversight, at least with respect to some of the questions that have arisen lately concerning Hillary Clinton, her husband Bill, others on their team, and what seemed to be evidence of collusion, actual collusion with the Russians. Again, Diana West and I talked about it earlier, but do you see signs that the House Intelligence Committee, on which you previously served, for example, is going to get in the business of serious oversight of what seems to be a burgeoning and very ominous scandal?
I think they are, and the House Oversight Committee is going to do that also. They have a scheme where both committees are going to look at classified and unclassified information on what is, I think, one of the worst scandals in American history, this elaborate collaboration between the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton campaign, and Russia. We heard yesterday that this dubious dossier on Trump was actually paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. Bill Clinton got $500,000 for a speech in Russia just as this decision on Uranium One was being made by Hillary Clinton. It's an enormous scandal, and I think the Republicans are finally getting serious about investigating it.
Well, let's pray they are, because I think we need to get to the bottom of this, and also, as Diana and I mulled, neutralizing those who have been involved in that scandal, who are now trying to investigate or simply manufacture another scandal, they would have us believe, involving Donald Trump and his alleged collusion with the Russians. Fred, so much more to talk about, but we're out of time for the moment. I appreciate yours today, as always, and Also, of course, your terrific service to the country, both in your previous incarnations and as a member of the senior staff of the Center for Security Policy. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.